Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Take a Knee, Give a Knee show. We thought it was time for Health Matters to weigh in on knees. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. Rick Phillips is on assignment in Isonville, and he will remain on assignment in Isonville until we get a few things straightened out I'll just leave it at that. But with us from the University of Kentucky, the physician assistant professor of the physician assistant program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Our website to listen to the show is wmky.org. Go to the Health Matters. But before you go to Health Matters, take a look at the other shows. They've got some excellent shows on there. There's a Time for Tales there. I am particularly fond of the Reader's Notebook. And also, of course, Chuck Mraz and the folks at Mountain Edition do some great work. And you can find back issues of those shows. But take a look at Health Matters, because we have been doing this now for 14 years. There are some back issues of our show that you might want to take a look at. After you've listened to them, record them, memorize them, and perform them in front of your family, then you can go to HM Radio Show, give us some feedback on these, and also check and see what we put in to our Facebook page. We have an article as we record this show on the ostrich knees, which I found to be interesting, and we also talk a lot about healthcare in Eastern Kentucky. That is our website, our sponsor for today's show, the knee replacement surgery. As the leg is bent, so goes the knee. I think that's loosely paraphrasing something or other. We've got our
very loose.
As always. I heard this somewhere, and then I forgot where I heard it. But at any rate, we've got 8 knee replacement facts. During a total knee replacement, an orthopedic surgeon removes the deteriorating joint surfaces and some of the bone in the knees and replaces them with metal and plastic implants. They should last around 20 years. And so here are some fun facts about knee replacement. First of all, over 600,000 procedures performed in 2009. It has gone up since then. We are aging baby boomers. We are mostly overweight, which puts extra stress on our knees. We like to do sports and stuff. And between those fun activities, we wind up wearing out our knees. Fun fact number two, most people who undergo a knee replacement are between the ages of 50 and 80. The average age is around 70. 60% of the recipients are women. The procedure has a high success rate, considered relatively safe and effective. Now, I've always said, you know, in terms of safety, a major surgery is a surgery that's performed on me or someone I love, regardless of the length of the incision or anything else. This is a big deal, getting a knee replaced.
Yeah, with the recovery time, and you're going to need some help when you go home afterwards. Does it mention how many of those folks end up with a subsequent knee replacement because they've worn out their first one?
You know, with that, starting at age 20 and going to age 80, and now an average of 20 years, you can see. I mean, there are going to be some people. It's one of the complications is a more rapid wear out, or you can break the knee. For the most part, it's a one-and-done operation between ages 50 and 80. Now, I have several friends who've had it in their 50s. People, oftentimes runners, have had that done in their 50s, and they're probably going to have a revision in their 70s, even if they take good care of that one. So there is that. I don't have a percentage, I don't think. One thing they mentioned, the most common reason for knee replacement is knee pain from osteoarthritis. That's the wear and tear arthritis from repeated motions of the knee, rather than trauma to the knee. 5 to 10% of people who need knee joint replacement have a history of blowing out their knees. But blowing out your knee does a lot more to the ligaments of the knee than it does to the joint surface, and usually those ligaments can be repaired. So it is not true that a blown knee or a ligament problem by itself leads to osteoarthritis. My understanding is the meniscus, the cartilage that lines the bony surfaces, and that's what the knees glide on. If that tears, then you are at higher risk for osteoarthritis and its complications. But simply having an accident to the knee where you may have lost your ACL or torn some ligaments does not necessarily predispose you to needing knee replacement. Fun fact number four, most knee replacement procedures take 1.5 to 2 hours to complete. An incision on the top of the knee can be as long as 10 inches, as short as 4 inches. Orthopedic surgeons are not particularly concerned about the cosmetic result. These are some pretty sizable scars. During the operation, they moved the kneecap to one side, cut away the damaged bone and cartilage, and then replaced that with new metal components and plastic. They're generally plastic liners where they come together. That is our first four of our eight knee replacement fun facts. And our sponsor, Total Knee Replacement, as the leg is bent, so goes the knee. Now, to start today's program, we've got some advice for those parents of very young children from the American Academy of Pediatrics 2017 conference. A guy named Charles Jennison, who was a pediatric emergency medicine physician at the University of Iowa, Carver College of Medicine, Iowa City. He said he had seen several patients with his career with tibia fractures. Tibia is the main weight-bearing bone in the lower leg. That occurred as a child was going down a slide. He had no idea of how often that happens. He was never told that there was a problem with a child sitting in your lap and going down the slide. Now, I remember, you know, you want to have the child have fun experiences and so forth. So you put this little infant child or very young child in your lap and you slide down the slide together. Did you do that with your son? Or
no, I didn't. But I not as an infant, but I remember as a small child doing those potato sack slides, you know, with my dad, where we'd go down together. But I've not done that with my son.
Well, they looked at the National Electronic Injury Surveillance System database. This is a database of all injuries nationwide that present to our nation's emergency rooms, and they're categorized by the type of injury. So they examined that to look for slide-related injuries. Almost 353,000 kids younger than 6 years old injured on slides in the United States from 2002 to 2015. That's about 27,000 children injured on slides every year. 60% were boys.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. This is the universal health matters rule. Whatever it is, if it's an injury, if it's caused by something stupid, boys are going to be two-thirds of those injured. Mm-hmm. So 60% injured were boys. Injuries different when you look at age group. Legs, more than 80% of slide incidents in children 11 months and younger. Legs, two-thirds of the incidents in children 12 to 18 months. And legs injured in half the incidents in children 18 to 23 months. So between 11 months, basically an infant under 11 months, and you get to a toddler who's 23 months old, you move from 80% leg injuries down to about half the leg injuries. When a child is sitting in the lap of an adult sliding down a slide, 94% of the injuries are to the legs. And they explain that. You know, this child, if the legs are going to bang against the side of the slide, not a problem when you've got a child who weighs 20 pounds, 30 pounds, something like that. When you add a 120-pound-plus adult driving that child's legs into the side of the slide, bad things happen. Yeah.
And then I guess friction, it's a twisting sort of a fracture.
Yeah. They can be some pretty nasty fractures, according to, Dr. Jennison. At age three, children are more likely to fall and basically we call it face plant. They come off the slide, they set their feet, and then their upper body keeps going. So they could fracture an arm when they reach out to break their fall or to hit their face, something like that. But these young kids sliding down in their parents' lap, if their leg comes into contact with anything and it's driven by the force of the weight of the adult that they're sitting in their lap, that's where the problem is. So in this case, the message is very clear. Parents, do not slide down a slide with your child, your infant child, in your lap. It's one at a time when the kids are bigger. It is also one at a time when they're small. And if they are too small to slide down the slide by themselves, then this is a pleasurable experience that your child should forego until they're big enough. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's okay. It'll be fun later on. Cora Bruner, Orthopedic and Sports Medicine Clinic at Seattle Children's Hospital, commented. She said she would advise letting children slide only when they're old enough and big enough to slide on their own. You could catch them at the bottom, and that might keep them from striking their face on the ground from the bottom of the slide. But this is a very strong message from Health Matters. It is not a good idea. And this, again, this came from the American Academy of Pediatrics 2017, their conference in Chicago. It is not a good idea to slide down a slide with an infant in your lap to provide them with the thrilling experience of getting their leg broken by 150 pounds plus of weight going down on top of it. Not a good idea.
No, not a good idea. They'll remember it when they're older anyway. It'll be more fun to slide.
Yeah, it will. Like I said, just let them gradually work into the slide. They can play on the bottom of the slide when they're barely walking, but please don't jump the gun and slide down with them in your lap. Next up, this was the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force draft recommendations for falls and fracture prevention, and this is something that was new. It was published on one of my references called Medscape on September 26. First of all, remember there are a lot of falls. In 2014, 2.8 million older adults in the United States sought treatment in the emergency room for falls. 2.8 million sought treatment. 800,000 required hospitalization. 27,000 died from a fall. And the average person over age 65 has 3 falls per year. And I was thinking about that. You know, I am fast approaching that 65 barrier. And, yeah, I fall quite a bit. Usually it involves dogs or not watching where I'm going. But I thought, well, sure. I mean, who doesn't fall? I didn't even think about it because usually I say, well, that was stupid. And I get up and dust myself off and I go on. And I've got a bruise or I've got a sore something or other. But I've managed to survive those falls. Have not yet been gone to the emergency room for a fall.
I probably have one good one a year. And it's after dark or I'm carrying a bunch of things and miss a step or something like that.
So you save up and have
careless.
A really good one.
Yeah, I save up for a really good one. Yeah. That's
okay.
How I do it.
Do you have any pet-related falls?
No, we have 2 outdoor bunnies as pets, so we don't really trip
you know,
over
and yeah, bunnies don't cause falls.
No, they don't.
They really don't. Cats, yes. Dogs, definitely. Yes. Bunnies, not so much.
No.
Snakes? I would fall down. If I had a snake, I think I would fall down. Because at some point, that snake would surprise me.
Yeah, some of them get pretty big, too. You could easily trip over it, like a cord.
Yeah, and then you would wonder whether the snake did that on purpose. This is the sort of thing I think about. That's why I don't have snakes. I don't think they're very good pets, and I would question their motives.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah, they're
it's
always
not like
shifty.
We're not snake people, in case you wondered. But back to the falls, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, there was the big focus in fall prevention now is to try to improve your balance and improve your muscle strength. That is, trying to make your legs stronger, trying to improve your balance so that you don't fall in the first place. This is absolutely the cornerstone of these recommendations. Now, our radio fans may be interested. The task force specifically mentions that vitamin D to try to improve muscle strength and bone strength, and calcium to try to improve bone strength, have no role, in their opinion, in either fall prevention or fracture prevention. That is, we thought these things were a good idea, and a lot of people, I myself as a physician, put a lot of people on calcium or put them on calcium and vitamin D, but at present, they do not feel that the evidence is sufficient to recommend that. This is a change from previous recommendations, and we wanted to make you aware of it. Meanwhile, you should be aware we're going to take a break. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio. Please stay tuned.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Take a Knee, Give a Knee show. It's our way of dealing with silliness. The problem is that your expression of support for one group offends another group, as the NFL has found you can't win. We can win just by making fun of everything and supporting no one, and that's what we do. And this is the Take a Knee, Give a Knee show. It's our salute to knees and some of the health complications of knees, as well as other stuff, which we will get into this fractional portion. With me from the University of Kentucky to continue to disagree and to keep me sharp, assistant professor and the physician assistant studies program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Our sponsor for the second time, knee replacement surgery. As the leg is bent, so goes the knee. We talked about our eight fun facts about knee replacement. Fun fact number one, 600,000 procedures performed per year or more. The most people receiving them are ages 50 to 80, average age around 70. 60% are women. Fun fact number three, the most common reason is pain from arthritis rather than trauma to the knee. 5 to 10% of people who get knee replacement surgery had a history of blowing out their knees. Not sure if they are overrepresented in that group or that's about 5 to 10% of people just blow out their knees anyway. Fun fact number four, most knee replacement procedures take 1.5 to 2 hours to complete. We described some of the surgical procedure a little bit last time in very much layman's term. Fun fact number five, serious complications such as knee joint infection occur in fewer than 2% of patients. But there are some things you need to know. The 30-day mortality rate, 1 month after you have your knee replacement, 1 in 400, 0.25%. 84% of those getting knee replacements are still living after 10 years. Now, you've got to put that in context. That is, you know, keep in mind, getting a knee replacement is a pretty big deal. It is like a stress test. If you are judged to be healthy enough and if you care enough to get your knees replaced, you are among the most healthy 50 to 80-year-old people around.
And the average age was 70, you said?
Yeah, average age was 70. And 84% still living after 10 years because we took these athletic, motivated 70-year-olds. We got them through a major surgery. And so it's pretty rosy on the backside of that.
Now, the infection rate, is that about standard for surgery?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Generally, 2% would be standard. 1.2% of people hospitalized for blood clots within 90 days. Knee implants can come loose. Again, a traumatic injury will knock it loose, and then you've got to have an immediate revision. Pain, surgery revision, about 10% of people require a revision within 10 years. You were asking about that. Mm-hmm. 4.5% of people under 65 experience some complication. And that could be anything from you might have a bowel problems moving your bowels after the anesthesia to pain to difficulty walking and so forth. 4.5% under age 65. Stiffness following the operation is not uncommon. 1% of replacements need revision because of a fibrotic condition where the joint actually kind of scars down. You have to go in and revise that because of that. That happens about 1% of total knee replacements. So there are several complications that can happen from it. On the flip side, I know a lot of people that have had a wonderful liberation from pain and disability from a knee replacement procedure. And the infection rate around 2%, and that includes all infections, a simple wound infection that you might need some antibiotics, all the way down to a joint infection, which is an absolute mess where you've got to just take the joint out. That is
start all over.
Yeah, and that is a thing that we fear. So there are those complications.
Do you think the rate of blood clots is coming down now that they're getting folks up much quicker now after surgery?
Yeah, I think so. We use a blood thinner universally after knee replacement surgery. And the other thing that's happened is the orthopedic surgeons, rather than trying to keep the people on their service post-op, as soon as the wound looks good, they get them into a rehab program. And the rehab people take over very early. So you're right. It's a more rapid, and it's also a more vigorous mobilization that I think helps some with the blood clots. Fun fact number six, we will stop there. Knee replacement surgery has improved over the years. And I got this from several different sources, and one of them was obviously a website about knee surgery that was encouraging you. So during the 1970s and early 1980s, knee replacement was the last resort. Today's instruments are better. They also mention, and this is why I included fun fact number six, there are now up to 200 implant size variations. And again, in the 70s and 80s, there were three or four different sizes, and that was it. And I know I had one patient who was absolutely thrilled. She had one knee implanted with what she called a man's knee, just a universal knee prosthesis. And the other one was specifically made for a woman. And she felt that her woman's knee was a much better knee than a man's knee because it was more appropriately sized for her leg and fitted better.
Yeah, I'd say for a woman-sized knee would be much more appropriate. I'd be happier.
So I don't know. You know, I think, yes, there have been some improvements, but you would expect that. We've improved a lot of things over the years, but I did think that all the different sizes of knees and trying to match the knee up to your own knee, doing that makes it a little less clunky. That is our sponsor. Knee replacement surgery as the leg is bent, so goes the knee. I've got several things, and Shelley and I talked about this on our way over to the studio here, related to tattoos and piercings. First of all, the American Academy of Pediatrics, again, this was in September in Chicago, they had their first report with guidance on tattoos and piercings in children. About half of people age 18 to 30 have some kind of piercing or tattoo. They said laser removal, not covered by insurance, cost up to $600 for a 3-inch tattoo. And I have seen some tattoos that are might even be larger than 3 inches.
Yeah, that would be pretty expensive to take some of them off.
Yeah. Complications are rare. People seeking tattoos or piercings should be up to date on all vaccinations. So that's the first thing. We've had some problems with hepatitis related to it. Tetanus and hepatitis are the two vaccinations you need to be up to date on. Your tetanus shot should be every 10 years. Most people, again, the way in this country to get vaccinated for tetanus is to do something stupid and go to the emergency room. And so most of us, if you've not had a tetanus shot in 5 years and you have some type of puncture wound, it doesn't have to be a rusty nail. It can be a very clean nail. If it punctures, then you need to get a tetanus shot. We do that also for bites and for other things that didn't involve nails.
Now, is that hepatitis B?
That is. You could, I suppose, hepatitis A, of course, is transmitted by drinking bad water or eating something that's contaminated. Hepatitis B is needle-borne, and hepatitis C. Hepatitis B is the one we vaccinate against. So if you, it would be a good idea to have a hepatitis B vaccination and certainly tetanus vaccine up to date before you go get a tattoo. Laws for consent differ by state, but 38 states have laws that ban body piercing or tattooing for minors without parental permission. But what that means then is that minors can certainly get tattooed. Kids can get tattooed. This is an important thing. Physicians should not see requests for tattoos or piercings as a form of self-injury. When you see someone with 7 or 8 piercings, that is not a cry for help. So if I can reassure parents and grandparents out there, just because a young person gets their body pierced or tattooed does not mean that they're contemplating suicide, that they need counseling. This is something that kids do. In my way of thinking, every kid needs counseling anyway.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess this would kind of be like the modern-day version of, I don't know, teenagers smoking marijuana in the 70s or whatever it was in the 50s, just to express themselves.
A couple of things can happen. You can have an allergic reaction to the metal. You certainly can have an infection. And sometimes infections and allergic reactions are difficult to separate. For some people, especially African Americans, they have exuberant scars, and they can get something called a keloid, a very large scar related to a piercing that they didn't intend to get. Ann Lawman, who's a professor of dermatology at Northwestern. When she goes to high school, she makes a list of the pros and cons of tattoos and piercings, recommends the students do that and then wait a few months rather than getting it done impulsively. Teens might also want to try a temporary tattoo before committing to permanent ink. It used to be taboo to talk about tattoos. How about that? It's really important now that we realize that this is something that's pervasive for younger people, many of them intend on getting tattoos or getting body piercings. And we, as parents, as friends, as advisors, and certainly those of us in the healthcare business, have to be aware that the standards, the norms, are changing on that.
Yeah, and they're probably here to stay. I know my son, who's 8. He goes to a birthday party or trick-or-treat or whatever. It's not uncommon for him to get those little temporary tattoos. You know, and kids think they're fun, and they'll put them all over themselves. You know, so it's normalizing it for him.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how I feel about it, but.
Yeah, and we know, I think we've all seen people with very extensive tattoos. Used to be, I won't say a sign of mental illness. I won't go that far. But I will say, very extensively tattooed people didn't necessarily live all that long. You did not see people in their 80s and 90s with their entire body tattooed.
No, they were kind of fringe people.
Yeah. But now, to be honest, I don't think that.
No. They have conventions. It's a big deal.
The reason we're having this free-form discussion about extensive tattoos is the next article that this was Hiram Castillo, it looks like Castillo Mitchell, from European Synchrotron Radiation Facility in France. They did, I'll read the article, I'll read the title of the article, and then I will explain it. Synchrotron-based XRF mapping and, nano XRF mapping and micro FTIR microscopy looking into the fate and effects of tattoo pigments in human skin. So you think, okay, I don't know what that is. It's a lot of technology. It turns out what they did was to take four human corpses with tattoos, and they looked at the lymph nodes in the region of the tattoo with this, mapping and microscopy. They looked for heavy metals. And it turns out that when you tattoo your skin, it breaks up. Some of the metallic pigments, and tattoos have metallic pigments, some of those metallic pigments, in fact, wind up in your lymph nodes. So they demonstrated this, that there were some. And the other thing they found was it changed the architecture of the lymph node. That is, the lymph node appeared to be scarred from this metal buildup from these tattoos. That's what they found, and they analyzed it several ways, and they found that the chromium, nickel, cobalt, and also I believe it was titanium. Don't see that. But at any rate, these heavy metals were in the lymph nodes. Now, these were people who had, I'll say, ordinary tattoos. People who had an area of their skin that had a picture tattooed on it. If you tattoo an entire arm or an entire leg, the metal load is substantially larger. Mm-hmm. If those metals cause inflammation in the lymph nodes, and they may leak to other organs, they didn't test the other organs, it is possible that these metals, some of which are carcinogens, could raise your risk of cancer.
Yeah. And I don't know anything about the henna ink for the temporary tattoos. Are there any like metals in those, in that ink?
I do not believe there are metals in henna. It was titanium. I've found that. So it was titanium. And that's one that they kind of worried about. But I don't think it's in henna. But the point is, you know, there's so many things like this where we are trying things. So tattoos became popular. Then using your body as a canvas for tattoo art, a tattoo across your entire back, a tattoo down one entire leg became popular. And you've got to realize we have no experience with this. As we talked about, extensively tattooed people, I did not see them. You and I both have had a lot of work with senior citizens, and I've seen tattoos, but I do not recall a single senior citizen in my career that I've seen that had an entire limb or an entire torso tattooed.
No, it's almost always an older gentleman with the military, you know, tattoo. Yep. from service days.
Yeah. So I don't know what's going to happen with this, theoretically, and we're not trying to raise alarm bells. We just want to make people aware. It's just never been studied. What does that kind of a burden, what does that do? Now, we know that tattoos, they vibrate, the metal vibrates when you put a person with extensive tattoos in an MRI scanner. It's sort of like a microwave for that tattoo, and it can make your skin pretty warm. So you're not able to get, in some cases with extensive tattoos, you may not be able to tolerate an MRI scan. And there may be some other things that metal does. We at Health Matters, well, we're not going to get extensive tattoos.
No.
So,
I'm also concerned about the, I guess they call themselves extreme body artists that have the implants put like in their face or in their head. I don't know what those implants are made of.
This is to make them look like a lizard or cat or something like that.
Yeah, that just doesn't seem healthy.
Now, that one might need counseling.
Yeah,
maybe. So far, it's been a look. You do your thing, we'll do ours. Nobody gets hurt here. But honestly, if you're trying to look like a lizard, if that's your goal in life,
well, I don't think any of these parlors or whatever they call them, where you go get a tattoo or go get a piercing or any of these extreme body art things done. Do you even sign a release? Do they tell you what's in the ink? Or you know, they don't. You don't know what you're putting inside or on your body.
Well, I'll say the same thing for a lot of surgeries. I mean, we know how it turns out, and the picture will come out the way, hopefully, if you have a good tattoo artist, the equipment will be sterile. You'll not get an infection. And that's pretty much the end of the inspections and licensing. If you don't get an infection within a month or two of having your tattoo, then that's where their responsibility ends. What about the long-term effects? What is this thing? Well, actually, nobody knows. So there isn't any information that can be given you. And I just want people to be aware that, especially with extensive tattoos, we have no track record. We have no understanding of what that does. And so it's not the tattoo person's fault. But if you're willing to step into that unknown and you recognize that there are heavy metals in the tattoo ink, then you make your own decision. As we said, we at Health Matters, we are satisfied that we look bad enough the way we came out of the package. And so we're not interested in additional things to make ourselves look worse. Next up, this one is fun. University of Nottingham published in Brain, Behavior, and Immunity. That's one of my regular reads, Brain, Behavior, and Immunity.
Yeah.
September 26th. Flu vaccine. The problem with flu vaccine, it is time to get your flu shot. We are already seeing at St. Clair, we're already seeing cases of the flu come in, sporadic across the nation, but it is definitely time now to get your flu shot. Flu vaccines, though, are not universally effective. Somewhere between 20% and half the time in older adults, they are effective. And then about 70 to 90% of younger people, they are effective. And by effective, we mean they mitigate the bad symptoms of influenza, not meaning that you can wade through influenza-infested halls and rooms and never receive a scratch, but simply saying your case won't be quite as bad. You will recover more quickly. They measured these groups published in Brain, Behavior, and Immunity. They wanted to figure out if they could improve the effectiveness of vaccine. So they looked at negative mood, positive mood, physical activity, diet, and sleep. Three times a week over a 6-week period in a group of 138 older people who were scheduled to have their flu vaccine, and then they measured the immunity. And it turns out the only thing that affected measurably your antibody response to the influenza vaccine was a positive mood.
So smile when you get that shot.
Yeah, so maybe a motivational speaker followed by an influenza vaccine. I don't know. I don't know what you do with that. Honestly, apparently you don't want to get the flu shot on a bad day. But to me, the day you get the flu shot's not going to be a great day anyway.
Yeah, no.
Let you think on that for a minute. We're going to take a break and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion. You're listening to the Health Matters Take a Knee, Give a Knee show. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and with me for the final segment, as she was for the previous two segments, from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Studies Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Our sponsor for the final time, knee replacement surgery. As the leg is bent, so goes the knee. We've got 8 fun facts about knee replacement. Fun fact number 1, 600,000 procedures performed in 2009. More than that by now, I am certain. That's the most recent numbers I found in a very cursory review. Fun fact number 2, the average age is 70. Most people are between ages 50 and 80. 60% of recipients are women. Fun fact number 3, the most common reason for knee replacement surgery is knee pain from arthritis rather than trauma to the knee. 5 to 10% of people who need a knee joint have had their knees blown out, but that is mainly damage to the ligaments and not actually to the bones in the joint itself. Fun fact number 4, most knee replacement surgeries take 1.5 to 2 hours to complete. Fun fact number 5, serious complications. And again, my definition of serious complication, any complication that happens to me or somebody I love. But serious complications, infection, less than 2%, 30-day mortality, 0.25%, 84% still living after 10 years, but you have selected people who are interested in walking more and people who can tolerate surgery, so that's not entirely fair. But an 84% survival after 10 years in people average age 70, that's pretty darn good. 1.2% chance of blood clots. You can also have to have a revision due to some complications with the knee. 4.5% of people have some complication during hospitalization. Older people more likely on that. And stiffness is not is a very common condition, but about 1% have fibrosis and scarring in the knee joint after the surgery, so that they have to have revision, or the knee motion is very markedly limited. Fun fact number six, it's improved over the years, and the only reason I put that in is because there are now over 200 implant size variations, and there were only three or four back in the 1980s. And we're now up to number six. Fun fact number six, surgery is not the only option, but wait till you hear these alternatives, and I know this will run. First of all, physical therapy. And I love physical therapy, and I am very fond of physical therapists. But physical therapy is a really tough sell for my patients, especially those that don't have a lot of money to put into this. Yeah. Medication to reduce pain and inflammation, that will be your arthritis pills. Once again, as a solution, they fall short. And then using an assisted device like a cane. And I'm telling you, that's what they say. Now, you can get a partial knee replacement. If the arthritis or the damage is limited to just one part of the knee, you may not have to have the full joint replacement. The other option, they mention this as fun fact number seven, and this is where we really make some progress. If you can lose weight, 25 pounds better than 25-pound weight loss better than any arthritis medicine on the market. So I want you to realize the thing that we have not mentioned, osteoarthritis of the knee, the most common reason for knee joint replacement, the most common condition that increases your risk of osteoarthritis, obesity.
So now we're asking people with painful knees to exercise.
Yeah, that's where it is difficult. Keep in mind, you're going to have to lose weight without being able to walk because you've got a bad knee.
And the anti-inflammatory medications that they take for the pain, is that's hard on your stomach. It doesn't play well with other medications. It could be bad for certain health conditions like hypertension.
But if you can lose weight, that will help reduce knee pain. The other thing, we mentioned exercise. If you do non-weight-bearing exercises, this would be lifting weights or riding a stationary bike, things like that, where you're not actually putting weight on the knee. If you can strengthen the muscles that surround the knee, then that holds the knee more firmly, less wobbling of the knee joint, and that actually improves it. So the best things you can do, lose weight and strengthen the muscles surrounding the knee joint. Those are the two absolute best things you could do. Everything else, the cane, the arthritis medicines, and the physical therapy is geared towards strengthening the knee muscles.
We need more water therapy. Is it, if someone with a bad knee could just get in a pool and just walk, it wouldn't be as painful. It'd be a lot easier on the joint. It's good exercise.
Yeah. Thinking about walking in a pool. Now, most of the pools, one of the problems is actually getting in the pool.
Right.
I've had some patients who were very, very obese, and really their knees could not support them for walking. I've said, why don't you walk into a pool? And one of my patients, I still remember, got in an above-ground pool and then actually was unable to get out and was tremendously embarrassed from that. And so we need to have ways, easy access, step-down pools.
Therapy pools.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you're going to put in a swimming pool, I mean, they show these great pools where people are swimming against a current and so forth, and those are all wonderful. But keep in mind, for a lot of us as we get older, just being able to get in and out of the thing is going to be the big question of the day, not can we swim 2 miles against a current. And then finally, fun fact number eight, studies show that upwards over 85% of people have a functioning joint 20 years after receiving it. That is, the survival time of these joints has increased markedly, so that for many people who are in their 70s, in their upper 60s and 70s, it's a one-and-done thing. You would not have to have a replacement joint in. And wearing out a knee joint for many of us is really not going to be a major concern or thing to worry about. That's our sponsor. Knee replacement surgery, as the leg is bent, so goes the knee. I saw this, and I don't know why it was news, but I thought we should talk about it. This was in a medical news feed in my email called Helio, spelled H-E-A-L-I-O, and there is a physician named Miriam Van Winkle. And right away you think, okay, if Miriam Van Winkle says something, MD, PhD, Ghent University in Belgium, she is in the Department of Pediatric and Medical Genetics. So I'm thinking, wow, she must be smart, and with a name like Van Winkle, I want to know what she's talking about. And she's talking about vegetarian diets for kids. My daughter, I have one daughter that I don't think she ever became a vegetarian. I had another daughter who was very athletic. She did the we call it power tumbling here as a form of gymnastics, a very high-energy sport. She also played varsity soccer, and she decided she would become a vegetarian. And my wife and I, we worried about a child being a vegetarian. I mean, not in the sense that it's immoral, but in the sense of how can we make sure our child is healthy and is growing if they are a vegetarian. And so Miriam Van Winkle says, well, here's the thing. A vegetarian diet excludes meat, obviously, and some exclude fish. There is the pesco vegetarian, which allows them to do that, to eat fish. There's a lacto-ovo-vegetarianism, milk, cheese, and eggs. So you've got several variations. If you can consume milk, eggs, and cheese, you're going to be fine. If you don't consume fish and don't consume milk, eggs, or cheese, you're getting close to a vegan diet, which vegan is absolutely no animal products allowed whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Miriam Van Winkle says, if you give a vegan diet to little children, you most certainly need vitamin supplements. It is dangerous without vitamin supplements. Vitamin B12 is the one that she focused on. She said it's present in animal food, less present in eggs and dairy than in meat or fish, but you don't need a lot, so you can get by with those. But if your child goes to a vegan diet, you really need, according to Miriam Van Winkle, you need to talk to a dietitian. A vegan diet, which does not allow any animal products, is very, very difficult to pull off. One, low energy, mm-hmm. and kids really need some high-energy food, and there aren't many plant options that are high-energy. And second, this vitamin B12, this thing is something that I worry about. You may be aware, I think I've said on this show before, I take vitamin B12 supplements. It turns out that vitamin B12 needs stomach acid, and it also needs something called intrinsic factor. And as we get older, we are less likely to have stomach acid in very large amounts and the intrinsic factor we need to absorb the vitamin B12. And think about that. If you've been taking one of those purple pills for heartburn, you have been suppressing your stomach acid for several years, then you may not be able to get the B12 you need, and you need to supplement. Well, these kids, if they are, particularly if they're vegan, but even if they're vegetarian, they're going to have lower rates of B12 absorption. And here's the thing, B12 is necessary for your brain and your nerves. I picked up this study from Nutrition Reviews. This was back in 2013, so it's a little bit older, but they just looked at B12 deficiency among vegetarians, take all comers, not kids, but adults. 62% of pregnant women, vegetarians, were deficient in B12. 25 to 86% of children, 20 to 40% adolescents, 11 to 90% in the elderly. Obviously, these are wide ranges. The point is, though, that B12 deficiency is common, and if you think of it as a brain and nerve vitamin, it's not something you really want to become deficient in. So if your child's going to be vegetarian, you've got to address the energy thing, and you can see that, but you also need to supplement B12. Now, they mentioned, well, if a child is thinking about being a vegetarian or vegan, you should consult a dietitian. That's great, but we don't have that many dietitians around here in Eastern Kentucky that you can just walk in and talk to them about a vegetarian diet. Right. On the other hand, I would say if your child is thinking about becoming a vegan, you need to get some help. You need to get some expert advice on that, because that can go wrong in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, kids, they need the high calorie, nutrient dense, and you'd have to eat a lot of broccoli to meet the calorie demands of a very active.
Yeah, I was just thinking. Well, I mean, you talk about carb loading before exercise or eating pasta and so forth, and I mean, you can if you go vegan, it's really difficult to find anything that that has a real high dense energy content. And these kids are doing a lot of sports and things. And so, sure, yeah, I mean, you could just deprive your child of that energy. They looked at stature, and I didn't see any definite tendencies in stature among child vegetarians. That is, you know, if your child's a vegetarian, my vegetarian daughter is a little short, but she's physically okay, and mentally she's not great. I mean, she's a weaver, so you know how far that goes. But still, I mean, she seems to be doing okay. So we don't think that she hurt herself. We did not know, and I think I would have. I think they got Flintstones or something like that. But I think I would have looked more carefully at B12 had I read from Miriam Van Winkle when my daughter was in her vegetarian phase.
I'd like to know, like, muscle mass on some of these kids versus the kids that eat, you know, whatever they want.
Yeah. Well, one thing about it, my son never even discussed vegetarianism. My son, loaded up with testosterone, was going to become the most muscly guy he possibly could. My daughters, on the other hand, with sensitivity toward the environment and the plight of animals and livestock and so forth, have varyingly restricted their meat intake.
That's what you get for raising them so well.
Next up, and we got time, I think, to do this one. This is moderate physical activity. This was a different study, and I know, Shelley, you looked this over and thought this was kind of interesting. This was reported out September 22nd, and it was two articles in The Lancet, which is the leading medical journal in Great Britain. And it also, to be honest, it rivals the New England Journal of Medicine as the top medical journal in the world. And they looked at physical activity around the world in different societies. As a matter of fact, this was between January 2003 and December 31st of 2010. 7 years, they looked at what they called a cohort study. They would pick one person that did the thing and one person that didn't, and they would try to figure out how important this was. And the thing they were doing was exercising. 130,000-plus people without any known heart disease, ages 35 to 70, 17 different countries. And they were high-income countries like Canada, Sweden, and the United Arab Emirates, upper-middle-income, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Poland, Turkey, Malaysia, South Africa, lower-middle-income, China, Colombia, Iran, low income, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, Zimbabwe. And they said, all right, for these people, what is the relationship between physical activity and mortality? Heart disease mortality, stroke, heart attacks, heart failure during this basically 9 years of follow-up. They had a international physical activity questionnaire. Low physical activity, less than 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity per week. Moderate, 150 to 750. And high physical activity, more than 750. Across all regions, the most common form of physical activity was active transportation, occupation, or domestic duties. That is, when we think of physical activity, we go to the gym. When these people think of physical activity, they do their job across all these countries and all these income levels. Moderate and high physical activity associated with a 28% reduction in death from any cause, 20% reduction in the risk for heart disease compared with low physical activity, moderate and high physical activity, reduction in major heart events, even in the high, middle, and the low-income countries, higher physical activity lowered your mortality rates. So, you know, whether your physical, and this was, you know, we've argued a lot about whether housework really is, or chores have health benefits. And this study says, I don't care what your income level is, if you are active, doing something, anything, your mortality is lowered.
I love this study. And the thing I like about it the most is, I know here in the United States, we've got lots of busy moms. You know, we're working, we're taking care of the kids, we're taking care of the husband, the household. It's hard to fit everything in, and so we neglect our own health and well-being the majority of the time. And then we beat ourselves up for it. So I really like the idea that I can count my housework. You know, I can count all those chores that I do when I go home in the evening and on the weekend as physical activity.
I like that you don't have to strap on your Fitbit, put on your special workout clothes, drive to the gym, take the escalator up to the gym and reserve a time for your personal trainer and so forth. You simply, if you get out, if you're active, you're walking, you're doing whatever, you're going to get some benefits from that.
But I did look up some calorie counts for 1 hour of common activities. So, can I quiz you?
Sure.
All right. Okay, we'll go with men first.
And by the way, I don't have the answers in front of me. A lot of times I put the answers in front of Rick so he doesn't look like he doesn't know what he's talking about.
All right, so 1 hour of chopping wood.
In terms of calories, that's going to be 400 calories.
388 calories. Good job.
All right.
Let's do one for the ladies. 1 hour of washing dishes while standing.
140.
88.
Ah!
I feel like we're being cheated. But I did find a really interesting one here. Elder care. If you take care of a disabled adult, 204 calories per hour.
More than washing the dishes. I guess if you're involved in transfers and so forth. Pretty neat. Thanks, Shelley. And thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, it's WMKY.org. Visit us on Facebook at HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, Health Matters and the prescription drug Vibersi have received warnings from the FDA.
Like Vibersi, we are a prescription radio show used to treat irritable bowel syndrome in adults where the main symptom is diarrhea. Our show works by decreasing bowel contractions, which leads to less diarrhea.
However, an FDA review found patients listening to our show have an increased risk of developing serious inflammation of the pancreas that could result in hospitalization or death. We're working with the FDA to address these safety concerns, you know, the hospitalization and death thing.
The FDA has recommended that our show should not be heard by patients who do not have a gallbladder. Those patients should consider alternative radio shows such as Mountain Edition.
Completely unrelated to this, Health Matters is offering to sell you a gallbladder for $19.95. Operators are standing by to rush you your gallbladder in this limited time offer.
Your risk of getting pancreatitis is also increased if you drink more than 3 alcoholic drinks a day. Limit your use of alcoholic drinks while you are listening to Health Matters.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.